Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I needed a little extra money for my electric bill recently, so I bought a EuroMillions ticket and I put it beneath the picture of Padre Pio that I keep propped on the back of my sofa. I'd found the picture one day in the gift shop at Whitefriar Street Church here in Dublin. I'd walked there from my flat to register a complaint about my love life with the relics of St. Valentine. I'm not Catholic, but I have a thing for the saints. It started when I was a teenager, and I left my home in the eastern United States to study for a year in Switzerland. It wasn't finishing school I attended there, except insofar as my unfamiliarity with cigarettes and alcohol came to a swift end. It's unreasonable to send a 17-year-old girl from rural America to a town with nightclubs and grappa and not expect a few virtues to get lost in the process. In the U.S., I'd grown up in a town of 800 people. My parents and brothers and I had attended a simple Lutheran church two blocks from my childhood home. We didn't have any saints there, unless you counted the church ladies who were up to their elbows in pie dough every week. Living in Switzerland, I grew accustomed to the sound of church bells ringing out each day over the piazza. On weekends, my friends and I took trains south into Italy. I developed a fondness for ducking into medieval cathedrals. I adored their hushed atmospheres, how their banks of flickering candles pushed up against cool shadows. It was on these trips that I first heard the clicking of rosary beads and names like St. Teresa, Padre Pio, and St. Francis of Assisi. I often found cards illustrated with the saints' images tucked into racks along the backs of the wooden pews. They held prayers to the saints and mentioned their specialties, which is how I found out that St. Francis was your man if you loved nature and animals, and that St. Mary Magdalene might throw a few extra blessings your way if you were a pharmacist or dabbled in perfumes. I didn't know if anyone was in charge of boosting the confidence of introverted blonde girls, but I said a prayer anyway for some help getting a date with Dario, my Italian crush. Returning to the United States, I moved home more times than I ever intended to. In each place I lived, I landed unexpectedly among different spiritual communities. In Pennsylvania, I developed a friendship with an Old Order Mennonite family who traveled to church by horse and buggy. In Maryland, I attended a Buddhist meditation group. In Virginia, I visited a metaphysical chapel that rested along the highway behind a border of cherry trees. I became a magpie of spiritual traditions. I read articles about Hinduism and the Druids. I feng shuied my bedroom. A Native American friend cleansed my aura with sage. Then I moved into a cabin in a western gold mining town. Awakening to the scent of wildflowers, the iron twinge of freshly fallen snow and peaceful reams of chimney smoke, I questioned for a while whether there was any real divide at all between heaven and earth. 2.5 years ago, I moved to Dublin, and I didn't realize how much I'd been missing the sight of cathedrals until I got here. I attend services now at Christ Church Cathedral. It's part of the Church of Ireland, and I'm drawn to it less by the familiar words spoken on Sunday mornings than by the same feeling that drew me into the churches I discovered in Italy as a teenager. That ancient pull toward a collective tide, the search for an enduring house from which I can extract a small stone of stability to drop into my pocket before returning into Dublin's churning urban waters of Viking-splashed tourist buses and crowded sidewalk cafes. I still love exploring other traditions. I believe, in the end, we're all part of the same web of existence, and to take one step on this earth is to tremble even the finest threads in heaven. Which means paying my electric bill is a spiritual pursuit, and I don't mind asking for a little help. I didn't win the EuroMillions jackpot, but I'll probably try again. Padre Pio looks happy enough to offer his support. In the picture on the back of my sofa, he has a friendly smile. We apparently share a fondness for fingerless gloves, although he's wearing his to cover the stigmata, and I just like mine because I got them at the Avoca off of Grafton Street, and they keep my hands warm, and they're pink.
It rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven? You'll find your fortune falling all over town. Be sure that your umbrella upside down, speedy. Trade them for a package of sunshine and flowers if you want the things you love.
The highest house. His mother came, he said, from halfway up a valley in Fanid. Theirs was the last house in the valley, she'd said, where the children weren't hired out to a farmer in Tyrone or the Lagan. Once, further west, I drove 3 miles up a bog road in the dark to a house so high it was named for the crag-roosting king of birds. A small, lit-up hostel under the hilltop. It rocked with young life. Hikers, holidaymakers from Japan, Germany, Holland. The cottage had been bought, extended, after the death of an old, cranky man who was hired at the fair for 6 months at the age of 6, instead of at the usual 9 or 10. The boy's sister, said the hostel owner, was hired out at the age of 7. No one, he said, shaking his head, was that poor. What do we know now of the humiliations of hunger and servitude, of having your arm muscles felt at a hiring fair, of the toss-penny chance of landing in a good place or a bad one? Of the slow burn of anger down the generations.
In my youth, one heard rumours that various Irish showbiz stars were big in Turkey. Likewise, as a novelist, however briefly, I was similarly big in Europe. This didn't bring in much money, but it brought some interesting television crews keen to film me. One Belgian crew seemed perplexed at my refusal to read from their pre-prepared script stating that James Joyce and I were both working-class writers born in Dublin's ancient liberties. A British World in Action crew decided that my interview would work better if it looked as if it was filmed at night. They spent hours buying every plastic bag in Fisborough to cover up my door and windows, creating an atmospheric light inside my house and consternation outside, where neighbours mistook them for medics trying to contain an infectious disease. I thought I'd seen everything until Swedish television sent a crew, or more accurately, a force of nature named Stig Claesson, with a film crew trailing behind him. Back then, I played football every Friday on a flooded pitch near Dublin Airport. When the Swedish crew emailed that they were arriving on a Friday evening, I replied that if any of them fancied a game of football, they could swing by the pitch, but otherwise I'd meet them later in a Dunkondra pub. Stig turned out to be 71 and not interested in football, but not interested in waiting around either. In lashing rain on a wintry night, he emerged like a miraculous apparition into the arc of floodlights illuminating the pitch, weaving among my startled fellow footballers with the bearing and grace of an ancient boxer. Behind him, a far younger cameraman struggled to keep up. Stig Claesson, a legendary Swedish writer, ignored the football whizzing past as he shouted, "Which one is Bulger?" When teammates pointed me out, he grabbed my drenched jersey and impassionately declared, There are only three reasons for a man to write: to get women, to get money, to get even. It was a memorable opening remark, and his conversation never slackened. Neither he nor I knew the inexplicable reason why he had been sent to interview me. Being too old for research, he had declined to read my novels in advance. He preferred to size people up in person. On this basis, he declared that I was a true writer, and as true writers, we should solemnly vow never to read a word of each other's work. As my Swedish was not the best, I was very happy to oblige. When we reached the pub, he informed every female drinker that I was a young Irish genius with whom they should embark on a romance. When they laughingly declined, he'd smile and ask if they might prefer to embark on a romance with an old Swedish genius instead. Stig was a ball of energy in that pub, charming everyone, leaving laughter in his wake. Yet behind his playfulness, I sensed the depths within this much-loved writer and illustrator who had written 80 books. Certain things were not to be joked at, and for him, writing was one. He was someone with a lifelong obsession with language, who understood the texture of words and magic of storytelling. Later, he confessed to finding modern Dublin dull, having last spent a day here in the 1960s drinking with Brendan Behan. That must have been one almighty clash of storytellers, each man drunk on words and on life, trying to outdo the other with anecdotes. I've no idea what Swedish television viewers made of our encounter, but I think he enjoyed my company because he stayed in touch for years, sending letters and gifts of his paintings of boxers in action. But the true gift he gave me was the gift of having met him. For years, when I'd meet Swedish people, they would call him a living national treasure. I'd tell them my Stig story, and they would tell me one 10 times funnier, like the time late in life when he agreed to enter a hospital to dry out, but arrived clutching his huge ancient typewriter, declaring that no cowboy should be separated from his six-shooter. In 2008, having boxed many rounds with life, winning some and losing others, Stig Claesson died. I felt privileged to have met this deeply funny and deeply serious man who knew acclaim and neglect, who, by his own admission, wrote some great books and others less great, but recognised that highs and lows are part of the journey. The true boxer is not the one who never gets knocked down, but the one who keeps getting up, just like the true writer is the one who keeps writing year after year, pretending that they do it to get money or get even, but really doing it because it is their destiny and they will never find enough years to tell every story in their head.
I am just a poor boy, though my story is seldom told. I have squandered my resistance for a pocket full of mumbles, such are promises. All lies and jest, still the man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest.
In May 1979, my classmates and I in Portlaoise, CBS, were busy revising for the Intercert. That is to say, we had one ear on the new RTE Radio 2 with its non-stop diet of chart hits coming at you. At the same time as we were struggling to memorise the key speeches from Shakespeare's Henry IV, Part 1. Among the most challenging were those in which the young Harry Percy, known as Hotspur, defends his decision not to turn prisoners of war over to the new king. The thing is, Hotspur doesn't trust King Henry. In fact, daily he's growing ever more sympathetic to the rebels who oppose the king, among them Mortimer, the Earl of March. Further adding to his vexation is the fact that the king's representative has turned up on the battlefield, not in the working clothes of a soldier, but fresh as a bridegroom, and newly shaved, or as Hotspur, i.e. Shakespeare, puts it, his chin new reaped showed like a stubble land at harvest home. It's the ultimate insult to the hot-blooded military man that someone would stop to prettify himself on his way to war. I've often wondered since about that image, the presumably decrepit vanquished army, and out of nowhere, this perfumed dandy showing up to herd them away like the spoils of victory. The unspeakable distance between the filthy work of the soldier and the dirty business of turning a profit from war. What struck me most then, however, was not just Hotspur's outrage, but the bizarre nature of the revenge he fantasizes against the king. Not for him the phial of poison poured slowly into the ear, or burial up to the neck in sand and subsequent starvation, or even one of the many daggers that littered the margins of Shakespeare's pages and stages. For Hotspur, the perfect weapon would be a common, even a vulgar, bird, the starling. The king forbade my tongue to speak of Mortimer, he says of the rebel leader, but I will find him when he is asleep, and in his ear I'll holler, Mortimer! Nay, I'll have a starling shall be taught to speak nothing but Mortimer, and give it to him to keep his anger still in motion. In short, Hotspur imagines the famous mimic bird driving the bad King Henry out of his tiny mind. Given the power of the image, revenge by speaking bird, surprisingly, this starling is the only appearance by the creature in all of Shakespeare. And if that doesn't seem remarkable at first, one must consider the veritable aviary, nay, the Noah's Ark that is particularly the plays. 54 crows, 51 doves, 36 eagles, 33 owls, 30 ravens, though admittedly two of those have more to do with raven-coloured hair than Gothic-looking birds. Where was I? There are 19 cuckoos, 17 nightingales, 16 hens and chickens, 11 swans, a faint swan, a snow-white swan, and a death divining swan among them. And what else? Two finches, two partridges, and two, or should I say, a brace of pheasants. And that's to ignore the 107 other references to unnamed species of bird. In short, a lot of birds. Yet just that single mention of a starling. And even so, this disproportionately small showing by starlings in Shakespeare's oeuvre, to use a word we poets love, was not enough to defer one Eugene Schefflin when he performed what must be among the most unusual tributes to his hero just over a century ago. A German immigrant to the US, Schefflin was so enamoured of the Bard of Avon as he was of birds, that he decided that all of the species mentioned in the bard's collected works must be found living wild in his new home in the United States. To that end, on 6th of March 1890, he, with a number of assistants, gathered in New York's Central Park, solemnly to release 60 members of the species Sternus vulgaris, the European starling, to you and me, which he'd had specially shipped across the Atlantic at considerable expense. Rounding them up to a tidy 100 the following year must have been for symbolic reasons. In any case, a century later, that first century of starlings, as it were, spreading their wings in their new habitat, had multiplied to more than 200 million individuals, forming startling starling flocks all over the East Coast, across the plains of Middle America, with its stubble lands at harvest home, as I myself have seen, and indeed right down along the entire stretch of the Pacific coast. In a book I came across the other day, Alcatraz, History and Design of an Island, There are even reports of starlings breathing today on the infamous prison rock in San Francisco Bay. The bard meets the bird man, I'm tempted to say. When I sat my intercert in 1979 in Portlaoise, a prison town itself, as it happens, as I put the last full stop to a barely comprehensible essay on Henry IV, Part 1, I thought I was done with it forever. But Shakespeare isn't like that. He doesn't let you go. And he doesn't let you go because so often there's some little musical phrase the stubble lands at harvest home among them that haunts you. The images come to life and won't give up. They begin to speak, and then they begin to speak to each other. You think it's about nothing, and suddenly it's about your whole world. You're out for a walk one day, and you think that's just a fragment, a single black dot on the landscape. And then suddenly, unexpectedly, the sky overhead is full of wheeling, startling life.
As traveller bureaus, there is no doubt that there will always be an opinion about our hair. It's not a question of colour, texture or length. It is more about what our hair symbolises. For many traveller bureaus, our hair brings self-love and pride. It is considered our most precious possession, our crown and glory. While historical images of traveller bureaus are scarce, those that are available often show how traveller women wore their hair in an adorned and creative fashion. The hair, be it in plaits or buns, was always out over her rug on her shoulders. This is unusual, in that other minority ethnic women, for religious or cultural reasons, tend to cover or hide their hair. How we look, how we dress, how we speak, has always been under surveillance by outsiders. Whether we're infants, children, teenagers, mothers or grandmothers, our hair has always been a signifier of our ethnicity, but also a talking point or social marker. Internally within the community, regardless of the changes that were forced on us, our hair has always been a source of strength and beauty. We wash it, we fix it, we style it, and in the same breath we love and hate it. Racism has not changed very much for traveller bureaus. When making an appointment in the hairdressers, there is always still a worry of being refused entry. Often we are turned away from a hairdresser the day or the morning of a wedding. Then there's the contemporary bullying and teasing of young traveller lackeys because of their long hair. My earliest memories are of my grandmother Bridget. She wore her hair in two long plaits until the day she died. The ritual of island hair has passed on to her grandchildren. It was a form of female bonding. The comb was often referred to as a rack, which was carried in your beady pocket. When my sisters or my mother would try and coax me to sit still for hair combing, my boldness and contrariness would be acted out. Then I would be put sitting on an upside down milk crate with a rug, flanked either side by Mary and Winnie, my sisters. Mother or grandmother would stand behind me, their knees cradling me, acting like a human armchair. The teeth of the metal comb would hurt, especially if my hair looked like a bird's nest, which it often did. But the combing was gentle. The hair oil smelled like gooseberries and other wintry fruits. While my mother poured it and rubbed my scalp, my compulsion to drink the oil was overwhelming. My mother's hands and fingers would gently tease the oil into my head. Slowly she'd comb and divide it into three different parts. Each of the three parts would be crisscrossed into a tight, neat plait. My mother was a small woman, just under 5 foot. She took on the establishment. The row was over my hair. I was attending a special school for children with disabilities. Short hair was considered manageable, and I was told I should have my long hair short. Long, it would command too much attention. But to us, short hair seemed to take away any sense of individuality. My communion was in 8 months. Mam dug her heels in. My mother and grandmother didn't just succeed in leaving my hair long. They managed to put it in ringlets under my communion veil. By the time of my confirmation, it was down to my hips. By then, all the girls in special school had learned to grow an oil and plait their hair. The hair oil was considered contraband. It was great fun oiling and plaiting each other's hair. This was a small revolution, but an important one. My mother took enormous pride in my long hair, but at 17, I was pulled in another direction. Most of my settled friends and peers had short hair. My massive mane seemed out of place. My memory is blurry, but the row with my mother was real. The shock, the disappointment, the anger and rage. The words that passed between us, they are etched in my heart. Every inch of me knew it was wrong, even at the time. I watched clumps of hair fall to the ground as my friend Grania snipped and snapped with the scissors. Neither of us knew what we were doing. We were trying to copy a pixie punk hairstyle from a magazine. This new hairstyle was a metaphor for a kind of internal conflict in me. Somehow a message of shame, related both to my ethnicity and my disabled body, had infiltrated my sense of self. My experience of short hair taught me many life lessons, mostly around judgment, perception, freedom and choice. As women, we were rarely forgiven for the mistakes we make, but Mam forgave me with an abundance of love. The 2 years of growing my hair out were excruciating, but after that I wore up styles, plain styles, work styles and fancy styles with a certain pride. Like many travel women, my hair is my trademark. While working, I wear it wrapped in a loose knot. For family occasions, my hair gets all the attention. Conditioning, straightening, curling, enjoying my hair is my greatest pleasure. Now it gives me a sense of elegance and grace. This combined with my disabled body is the perfect pervy aesthetic.
Black is the colour of my true love's hair. Her lips are like some roses fair. She has the sweetest smile and the gentlest hands, and I love the ground whereon she stands.
In his wonderful book, 32 Words for Field, Monken McGann devotes a chapter to belief in fairies and spirit creatures and suggests there are psychological benefits to acknowledging another layer of existence alongside the here and now. My mother sprang to mind. That there was an open channel of communication to saints through prayer and to spirits through pishogues was undoubtedly a comfort to her. But for her, as for many of us, the dividing line between religion and superstition was a bit blurry. She regularly bribed St. Anthony with offers of money in return for help in locating misplaced keys or gloves. As the fee rose and fell in proportion to the value of the missing item, St. Anthony came to resemble one of those lucky Hollywood actors whose contract automatically includes a percentage of the profits. Although she never purchased a statue of the Child of Prague because she was unconvinced by claims he could influence the weather, she nevertheless felt it prudent in the run-up to my sister's January wedding to borrow one and place it under the hedge in the back garden to ward off rain. When the big day dawned with a mixture of snow and sunshine, she felt the most the Child of Prague deserved was a B for effort. My mother worked for many years as a general nurse, theatre sister and midwife. Despite her medical training, when my brother was afflicted by an outbreak of warts of biblical proportions on his left hand, she chose to ignore conventional medicine and opted instead for a folk cure from her native Armagh. This involved spitting on a small piece of beef, which was then rubbed on the warts, and buried in the garden at midnight, to the accompaniment of prayers and imprecations. It worked. Within only 2 or perhaps 3 years, my brother was declared wart-free. I'm happy to report he remains wart-free to this day. The school's collection is a treasure trove of such beliefs, gathered by schoolchildren from all parts of the country in the late 1930s. A child in Inishni, near Roundstone in Connemara, writes that a cure for whooping cough is to ask a man riding a white horse for advice and to follow whatever instructions he gives. Arthritis can be eased by drinking water from the three wells nearest your house. Toothache can be cured forever, she assures us, by placing a frog in one's mouth for a few minutes. Most of us think of these superstitions as relics of a simpler age, one when it was easier to believe in miracles and cures and healing wells, but which vanished once the electric light and the television were switched on all across Ireland. Yet it's not that long ago that a friend of mine, also in Inishni, showed me that belief in liminal forces was alive and well. Sean had wanted to clear a piece of the shoreline to create a more convenient spot to moor his new curragh. This was a big job. It necessitated manhandling stones and boulders out of the way. Larger rocks were split by means of the age-old method of lighting turf fires on them and then rapidly cooling them with seawater. A day or two into the work, he was approached by an older neighbour who asked him what he was at. When Sean explained, the neighbour looked at him witheringly and said, "There are better men than you, Sean, who lived here and who never moved those stones. You won't have a day's luck." He turned on his heel and walked away. Sean was rattled. He felt as if his neighbour had summoned agents of retribution, perhaps divine, perhaps the Dhini Maha, to put manners on him. In his eagerness for a new mooring place, it had never occurred to him that by moving a few rocks that had lain untouched for countless generations, he was not just disturbing the shoreline, he had dared to disturb the universe. I met him a few weeks later, and he told me that, sure enough, the bad luck had started. He held up a homemade walking stick. He'd been out gathering sheep on the hill at the back of Kinraver, and for the first time in his life had slipped and twisted his ankle. Not only that, one of his calves had just fallen sick. That was two pieces of bad luck. There would be three, he said. A third thing was on the way. I should never have gone near the shore, he said. I commiserated with him and made vague comforting sounds to the effect that he shouldn't worry about that kind of stuff. They were just accidents. No accidents, no accidents, he said ruefully. The next day, when I dropped in, his spirits seemed to have lifted a little. Watch this now, he said. He produced a box of matches. I'm going to break the spell. He took a match from the box, held it up in front of me, and very deliberately snapped it in two. This simple remedy seemed to reassure him. And it reassured him so much that it also reassured me. And I thought, it wouldn't kill me to place some faith in miracles and cures and healing wells.
On this morning's programme, we heard A Prayer for the Electric by Elizabeth Oxley, The Highest House, a poem by Moya Cannon, The Writer Who Came In from the Cold by Dermot Bulger, and from the recent Miscellany Archive, Talking Birds by Pat Boren, followed by Crowning Glory by Rosaline McDonough, and Miracles and Cures and Healing Wells by Conall Hamill. The music was Pennies from Heaven by Rose Murphy, The Kid on the Mountain by Emer McGeown on whistle and Barry Douglas on piano, The Boxer by Simon and Garfunkel, Bird's Lament by Moondog, and Black is the Colour, sung by Christy Moore. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon, and the producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can listen back on the RTE Radio app or on the programme website, rte.ie/radio1/Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.